Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the show. We are finishing out the amazing piece by Nick Szabo, shelling out the origins of the money, the origins of money, today with part four. If you have not listened to part one through three, I definitely encourage you to go back or you're going to be kind of lost. We just covered the section about inheritance and the ability of collectibles. It's high usage in moving wealth across generations, and then its application in marriage and when it was transferred to one clan from one clan to another, and the reasons why, and the frequency in which that happened, and then we are jumping into the case of tribute or the spoils of war. And that's what our current section is on. As we finish this out, we'd start now with the spoils of war. Death rates from violence in chimp troops and hunter-gatherer human cultures alike are far higher than in modern civilizations. This probably dates at least as far back as our common ancestor with the chimpanzees. Chimp troops, as well, are constantly fighting. Warfare involved, among other things, killing, maiming, torture, kidnapping, rape, and the extortion of tribute in exchange for avoiding such fates. When two neighbor tribes were not at war, one was usually paying tribute to the other. Tribute could also serve to bind alliances, achieving economies of scale in warfare. Mostly, it was a form of exploitation more lucrative to the victor than further violence against the defeated. Victory in war was sometimes followed by an immediate payment from the losers to the winners. Often this just took the form of looting by the enthusiastic victors, while the losers desperately hid their collectibles. More often, tribute was demanded on a regular basis. In this case, the triple coincidence could and sometimes was avoided by a sophisticated schedule of payments in kind that matched the losing tribe's ability to supply a good or service with the victor's demand for it. However, even with this solution, primitive money could provide a better way, a common medium of value that greatly simplified the terms of payment. Very important in an era when terms of the treaty could not be recorded but had to be memorized. In some cases, as with the wampum, as used in the Iroquois Confederacy, the collectibles doubled as a primitive mnemonic device that, while not verbatim, could be used as an aid to recall the terms of the treaty. For the winners, collectibles provided a way to collect tribute at closer to the laffer optimum. For the losers, collectibles buried in caches provide a way to underreport, leading the victors to believe the losers were less wealthy and thus demand less than they might. Caches of collectibles also provided insurance against overzealous tribute collectors. Much of the wealth in primitive societies escaped the notice of the missionaries and anthropologists due to its highly secretive nature. Only archaeology can reveal the existence of this hidden wealth. Hiding and other strategies presented a problem that tribute collectors share with modern tax collectors: how to estimate the amount of wealth they can extract. Value measurement is a thorny problem in many kinds of transactions, but never more so than in the antagonistic collection of tax or tribute. In making these very difficult and non-intuitive trade-offs, and then executing them in a series of queries, audits, and collection actions, tribute collectors efficiently optimized their revenue, even if the results seemed quite wasteful to the tribute payer. Imagine a tribe collecting tribute from several neighbor tribes it previously defeated in war. It must estimate how much it can extract from each tribe. Bad estimates leave the wealth of some tribes understated while forcing others to pay tribute based on estimates of wealth they don't actually have. The result? The tribes that are hurt tend to shrink. The tribes that benefit pay less tribute than could be extracted. In both cases, less revenue is generated for the victors than they might be able to get with better rules. This is an application of the Laffer curve to the fortunes of specific tribes. On this curve, applied to income taxes by the brilliant economist Arthur Laffer, as the tax rate increases, the amount of revenue increases, but at an increasingly slower rate than the tax rate, due to increased avoidance, evasion, and most of all, disincentive to engage in the taxed activity. At a certain rate, due to these reasons, tax revenues are optimized. Hiking the tax rate beyond the Laffer optimum results in lower rather than higher revenues for the government. Ironically, the Laffer curve was used by advocates for lower taxes, even though it's a theory of tax collection optimum to government revenue, not a theory of tax collection optimal to social welfare or individual preference satisfaction. On a larger scale, the Laffer curve may be the most important economic law of political history. Charles Adams uses it to explain the rise and fall of empires. The most successful governments have been implicitly guided by their own incentives, both their short-term desire for revenue and their long-term success against other governments, to optimize their revenues according to the Laffer curve. Governments that overburdened their taxpayers, such as the Soviet Union and Roman Empire, ended up on the dust heap of history, while governments that collected below the optimum were often conquered by their better-funded neighbors. Democratic governments may maintain high tax revenues over historical time by more peaceful means than conquering underfunded states. They are the first states in history with tax revenues so high relative to external threats that they have the luxury of spending most of the money on non-military areas. Their tax regimes have operated closer to the Laffer optimum than those of previous kinds of governments. Alternatively, this luxury may be made possible by the efficiency of nuclear weapons in deterring attack, rather than the increased incentives of democracies to optimize to tax collection. When we apply the Laffer curve to examining the relative impact of treaty tribute terms on various tribes, we conclude that the desire to optimize revenues causes victors to want to accurately measure the income and wealth of the vanquished. Measuring value is crucial to determining the tributary's incentives to avoid or evade the tribute by hiding wealth, fight, or flight. For their part, tributaries can and do spoof these measurements in various ways, for example, by burying collectibles in caches. Tribute collection involves a measurement game with unaligned incentives. With collectibles, one can demand tribute at strategically optimal times instead of when items can be supplied by the tributary or is in demand by the victor. The victors can then choose when they will in the future consume the wealth, rather than having to consume it at the time the tribute is extracted. Much later, well into the dawn of history in 700 BC, though trade was widespread, money still took the form of collectibles. Made out of more precious metals, but in their basic characteristics, such as a lack of uniform value, similar to most of the proto-money used since the dawn of Homo sapiens sapiens. This was changed by a Greek-speaking culture in Anatolia, modern Turkey, the Lydians. Specifically, the kings of Lydia were the first major issuers of coins in the archaeological and historical record. From that day to this, government mints with self-granted monopolies, rather than private mints, have been the main issuers of coin. Why wasn't minting dominated by private interests, such as private bankers, which did exist at the time in these semi-market economies? The main explanation for government dominance of coin minting has been that only governments can enforce anti-counterfeiting measures. However, they could have enforced such measures in protection of competing private mints. just as they enforce trademarks today and at that time as well. It was far easier to estimate the value of a coin than that of a collectible, especially at low transaction values. Far more trades could be made with money instead of barter. Indeed, many kinds of low-value trades became possible for the first time as the small gains from trade for the first time exceeded transaction costs. Collectibles were low-velocity money, involved in a small number of high-value transactions. Coins were high-velocity money, facilitating a large number of low-value trades. Given what we have seen about the benefits of proto-money to tribute and tax collectors, as well as the critical nature of the value measurement problem in optimally coercing such payments, it is not surprising that tax collectors, specifically the kings of Lydia, were the first major issuers of coinage. The king, deriving his revenue from tax collection, had a strong incentive to measure the value of wealth held and exchanged by his subjects more accurately. That the exchange also benefited from cheaper measurement by traders of the medium of exchange, creating something closer to efficient markets, and allowing individuals to enter into the marketplace on a larger scale for the first time, was for the king a fortuitous side effect. The greater wealth flowing through markets now available to be taxed boosted the king's revenues even beyond the normal Laffer curve effect of reducing mismeasurement between given tax sources. This combination of more efficient tax collection with more efficient markets meant a vast increase in overall tax revenues. These tax collectors almost literally hit a gold mine, and the wealth of Lydian kings Midas, Croesus, and Gyges is famous to this day. A few centuries later, the Greek king Alexander the Great conquered Egypt, Persia, and much of India, funding his spectacular conquest by plundering Egyptian and Persian temples, filled with assemblages of low-velocity collectibles, and melting them down into high-velocity coins. More efficient and encompassing market economies, as well as more efficient tax collection, sprung up in his wake. Tribute payments did not form by themselves a closed loop of collectibles. These were only valuable if they ultimately could be used by the victors for something else, such as marriage, trade, or collateral. However, victors could coerce the vanquished into manufacturing for obtaining collectibles, even if it did not serve the vanquished's voluntary interests. Disputes and remedies. Ancient hunter-gatherers did not have our modern tort or criminal law, but they did have an analogous means of settling disputes, often judged by clan or tribal leaders or vote, that covered what modern law calls crimes and torts. Settling disputes through punishments or payment sanction by the clans of the disputing parties substituted for cycles of revenge or vendetta wars. Most pre-modern cultures, ranging from the Iroquois in America to the pre-Christian Germanic peoples, decided that payment was better than punishment. Prices, for example, the Germanic Wehrgeld and Iroquois blood money, were assigned to all actionable offenses, ranging from petty theft to rape to murder. Where money was available, the payment took the form of money. Livestock was used in herding cultures. Otherwise, payment of collectibles were the most commonly used remedy. The payment of remedies for damages in a lawsuit or similar complaint led to the same kind of problem of triple coincidence of event, supply, and demand, as occurred in inheritance, marriage, and tribute. The judgment of the case had to coincide with the ability of the plaintiff to pay the damages as well as the opportunity and desire of the defendant to benefit from them. If the remedy was a consumable the plaintiff already had plenty of, the remedy still served as a punishment but would not likely satisfy the defendant, and thus would not curb the cycle of violence. Thus we find here again the value added by collectibles, in this case in making possible the remedy to resolve a dispute or terminate a cycle of revenge. dispute remedies would not form a closed loop if the payments served to entirely eliminate vendettas. However, if the payments did not completely damp the vendetta, the payments could form a cycle following the cycle of revenge. For this reason, it is possible that the institution reached an equilibrium when it had reduced but not eliminated cycles of revenge until the advent of more densely connected trading networks. Attributes of collectibles. Since humans evolved in small, largely self-sufficient, and mutually antagonistic tribes, the use of collectibles to reduce the need for favor tracking and to make possible the other human institutions of wealth transfer we've explored was far more important than the scale problems of barter for most of the time span of our species. Indeed, collectibles provided a fundamental improvement to the workings of reciprocal altruism, allowing humans to cooperate in ways unavailable to other species. For them, reciprocal altruism is severely limited by unreliable memory. Some other species have large brains, build their own homes, or make and use tools. No other species has produced such an improvement to the workings of reciprocal altruism. The evidence indicates this new development had matured by 40,000 BP, or before present. Menger called this first money an intermediate commodity, what this paper calls collectibles. An artifact useful for other things, such as cutting, could also be used as a collectible. However, once institutions involving wealth transfer became valuable, collectibles would be manufactured just for their collectible properties. What are these properties? For a particular commodity to be chosen as a valuable collectible, it would have had, relative to products less valuable as collectibles, at least the following desirable qualities. 1. More secure from accidental loss and theft. For most of history, this meant carryable, on the person, and easy to hide. 2. Harder to forge its value. An important subset of these are products that are unforgeably costly and therefore considered valuable, for reasons explained below. And 3. This value was more accurately approximated by simple observations or measurements. These observations would have had more reliable integrity, yet have been less expensive. Humans the world over are strongly motivated to collect items that better satisfy these properties. Some of this motivation probably includes genetically evolved instincts. Some objects are collected for the sheer pleasure of collecting them, not for any particularly good, explicit, and proximate reasons. And such pleasure is nearly universal across human cultures. One of the immediate proximate motivations is decoration. According to Dr. Mary C. Steiner, an archaeologist at the University of Arizona, quote, "Ornamentation is universal among all modern human foragers," end quote. For an evolutionary psychologist, such a behavior that has a good ultimate explanation in terms of natural selection but has no proximate rationale other than pleasure is a prime candidate to be a genetically evolved pleasure that motivates the behavior. Such is, if the reasoning in this essay is correct, the human instinct to collect rare items, art, and especially jewelry. Point 2 requires some further explanation. At first, the production of a commodity simply because it is costly seems quite wasteful. However, the unforgeably costly commodity repeatedly adds value by enabling beneficial wealth transfers. More of the cost is recouped every time a transaction is made possible or made less expensive. The cost, initially a complete waste, is amortized over many transactions. The monetary value of precious metals is based on this principle. It also applies to collectibles, which are more prized the rarer they are and the less forgeable this rarity is. It also applies where provably skilled or unique human labor is added to the product, as with art. We have never discovered or made a product that does really well on all three scores. art and collectibles in the sense that word is used in modern culture rather in the technical sense it is used in this paper, optimize two, but not one or three. Common beads satisfy one, but not two or three. Jewelry, made at first out of the most beautiful and less common shells, but eventually, in many cultures, out of precious metals, comes closer to satisfying all three properties. It is no coincidence that precious metal jewelry usually came in thin forms such as chains and rings, allowing for inexpensive assaying at randomly chosen locations. Coins were a further improvement. Substituting small standard weights and trademarks for assays greatly reduced the cost of small transactions using precious metals. Money proper was just a further step in the evolution of collectibles. The kind of mobile art also made by Paleolithic man, small figurines and the like, also matches these characteristics well. Indeed, Paleolithic man made very few objects that were not either utilitarian or shared characteristics 1 through 3. There are many puzzling instances of useless or at least unused flints with Homo sapiens. We have mentioned the unusable flints of the Clovis people. Kulief discusses a European Mesolithic era find of hundreds of flints, carefully crafted, but which micrograph analysis reveals were never used for cutting. Flints were quite likely the first collectibles, preceding special-purpose collectibles like jewelry. Indeed, the first flint collectibles would have been made for their cutting utility. Their added value as a medium of wealth transfer was a fortuitous side effect that enabled the institutions described in this article to blossom. These institutions, in turn, would have motivated the manufacture of special-purpose collectibles. At first, flints that need have no actual use as a cutting tool, then the wide variety of other kinds of collectibles that were developed by Homo sapiens sapiens. During the Neolithic era, in many parts of the Middle East and Europe, some kinds of jewelry became more standardized, to the point where standard sizes and assayability were often valued over beauty. In commercial areas, the quantity of this jewelry sometimes greatly exceeded that of traditional jewelry in hoards. This is an intermediate step between jewelry and coins, when some collectibles increasingly took a fungible form. Around 700 BC, the Lydian kings started issuing coins as described above. The unforgeable costliness of standard weights of precious metals could now be assayed in a marketplace by wage earners or by tax collectors via trademark, i.e. trust in the mint's brand, instead of chopping coiled wire at a randomly selected spot. It is no coincidence that the attributes of collectibles are shared with precious metals, coins, and the reserve commodities that have backed most non-fiat currencies. Money proper implemented these properties as purer form than the collectibles used during almost all of human prehistory. A novelty of the 20th century was the issue of fiat currencies by governments. Fiat means not backed by any reserve commodity, as the gold and silver-based currencies of previous centuries were. While generally excellent as media of exchange, fiat currencies has proven to be very poor stores of value. Inflation has destroyed many a nest egg. It is no coincidence that markets in rare objects and unique artwork, usually sharing the attributes of collectibles described above, have enjoyed a renaissance during the last century. One of our most advanced high-tech marketplaces, eBay, is centered around these objects of primordial economic qualities. The collectibles market is larger than ever, even if the fraction of our wealth invested in them is smaller than when they were crucial to evolutionary success. Collectibles both satisfy our instinctive urges and remain useful in their ancient role as a secure store of value. Conclusion. Many kinds of wealth transfers, one-way and mutual, voluntary and coerced, face transaction costs. In voluntary trades, both parties gain. A truly free gift is usually an act of kin altruism. These transactions create value for one or both parties as much as the physical act of making something. tribute benefits the victor, and a judgment of damages can prevent further violence as well as benefiting the victim. Inheritance made humans the first animals to pass wealth to their next generation kin. These heirlooms could in turn be used as collateral or payment in trade for goods, for food to stave off starvation, or to pay a marriage bride price. Whether the costs of making these transfers, transaction costs, are low enough to make the transfers worthwhile is another matter. Collectibles were crucial in making these kinds of transactions possible for the first time. Collectibles augmented our large brains and language as solutions to the prisoner's dilemma that keeps almost all animals from cooperating via delayed reciprocation with non-kin. Reputational beliefs can suffer from two major kinds of errors: errors of about which person did what, and errors in appraising the value or damages caused by that act. Within clans, the small and immediately local kin group or extended family which formed a subset of a tribe, our large brains could minimize these errors so that public reputation and coercive sanctions superseded the limited motivation provided by the counterparty's ability to cooperate or defect in the future as the main enforcer of delayed reciprocation. In both Homo sapiens neanderthalis and Homo sapiens sapiens, with the same large brain size, it is quite likely that every local clan member kept track of every other local clan member's favors. The use of collectibles for trade within the small local kin group may have been minimal. Between clans within a tribe, both favor tracking and collectibles were used. Between tribes, collectibles entirely replaced reputation as the enforcer of reciprocation, although violence still played a major role in enforcing rights as well as being a high transaction cost that prevented most kinds of trade. To be useful as a general purpose store of wealth and means of wealth transfer, a collectible had to be embedded in at least one institution with a closed loop cycle, so that the cost of discovering and/or manufacturing the object was amortized over multiple transactions. Furthermore, a collectible was not just any kind of beautiful decorative object. It had to have certain functional properties, such as the security of being wearable on the person, compactness for hiding or burial, and unforgeable costliness. That costliness must have been verifiable by the recipient of the transfer, using many of the same skills that collectors use to appraise collectibles today. The theories presented in this paper can be tested by looking for these characteristics, or the lack of them, in the, quote, valuables often exchanged in these cultures, by examining the economic gains from cycles through which these valuables move, and by observing preferences for objects with these characteristics in a wide variety of cultures, including modern ones. With its unprecedented technology of cooperation, humans had become the most fearsome predator ever seen on the planet. They adapted to a shifting climate, while dozens of their large herd prey were driven by the hunting and the climate change in America, Europe, and Asia to extinction. Today, most large animals on the planet are afraid of projectiles, an adaptation to only one species of predator. Cultures based more on gathering than hunting also greatly benefited. A population explosion followed. Homo sapiens sapiens was able to populate more parts of the planet and at a density over 10 times that of Homo sapiens neanderthalis, despite weaker bones and no increase in brain size. Much of this increase may be attributed to the social institutions made possible by effective wealth transfer and language. Trade, marriage, inheritance, tribute, collateral, and the ability to assess damages to dampen cycles of vengeance. Primitive money was not modern money as we know it. It took on some of the function modern money now performs, but its form was that of heirlooms, jewelry, and other collectibles. The use of these is so ancient that the desires to explore, collect, make, display, appraise, carefully store, and trade collectibles are human universals, to some extent, instincts. This constellation of human desires might be called the collecting instinct. Searching for the raw materials, such as shells and teeth, and manufacturing of collectibles took up a considerable portion of many ancient humans' time, just as many modern humans expend substantial resources on these activities as hobbies. The results for our ancient forebears were the first secure forms of embodied value, very different from concrete utility, and the forerunner of today's money. And we have done it. That concludes the amazing piece by Nick Szabo, Shelling Out, The Origins of Money. I hope you guys enjoyed that one. Don't forget to follow Nick Szabo and check out the Nakamoto Institute. This was just an amazing piece, particularly in my... I had been studying for a long time the importance of money and how money was a great tool for... squeezing the time difference between the present and the future, or the past and the present, and how it's able to carry value in ways that no other good is able to. And I did that like reading Hayek and Mises and Rothbard, mostly Rothbard. I didn't actually get to Mises until much later on, actually. So I had heard a lot of these messages before, but when I read this for the first time, it was the beginning of my realization that you can't build society without that tool, that the cooperation between people is not possible, and the ability to move value efficiently across time shifts the mental mental framing of people from a extremely high time preference to a very low time preference mentality, where you invest in longer-term projects. You begin to see things as a civilization where you can make a difference as an individual and move for those long-term projects, for those big investments, as opposed to small, strictly consumable survival, like high-time preference investments or consumption. And it was just, this one just really hit me because there was such a beautiful piece of, like, could this be the reason? Could money really be the foundation for why humans are able to cooperate? And you begin to see that, like, it is where we trade that we are actually able to produce and exchange things peacefully, and we do it all day, every day. It's such a piece of everything, but it's like, it's one of those things, the fish doesn't know it's wet. It's so prevalent that it's taken for granted. People don't even think about why or how trade happens. Of course it happens. Trade is everywhere. That's how you get all of your things. I mean, think about anything that you have that you actually made, or that you made without using tools made by somebody else. The incredible amount of production, every single thing in our lives is acquired because we can do one task at how many thousands of levels above, like, what you would come into contact with, like, in the woods and, like, alone, naked in the woods. Like, what can you do with your bare hands in the woods versus what can you do with computers, with cars, with televisions, with the internet, with cell phones, like all of these things at your disposal. You can do one task at the height of this giant tree of things that people have worked on and stacked on and traded, ideas exchanged and turned into billions of different products and solutions to problems, so that you can do that one thing and trade the value of that one thing, your job or whatever it is you're good at it, whether you're making a podcast or you're learning things and trying to explain it to other people, or you're washing dishes. Just that one thing allows you to get the tool, the one tool, the proxy, money, that gives you access to every single other thing in that tree. The billions of other products are acquirable because you can trade your one thing that you do or you that you choose to do. Maybe it's many things. A lot of people, you know, obviously that's just a, I'm just talking about a job in this context, but you get to trade that one thing for an ocean of limitless possibilities. Anything that is possible and is being made, you can acquire with money. And without that, when that tool starts to break apart and starts to fail in its job because it's being corrupted, society literally falls apart. That's why socialism doesn't work, because it attempts to lead the market. It attempts to tell, to get a group of bureaucrats together to tell everybody what the prices are or what's important and not. And it just destroys the economic allocation that money makes possible. And it's just fascinating that one tool could have such, like one technology could have such a giant effect on every single thing that we do. Our mentality, our culture, our, obviously our productivity, who can, how many people we can sustain and survive, our future versus like our past and our present, the price of those things in relation to each other. It's just such an encompassing technology that nothing else would be possible without it. You can't build anything else without that at its foundation. And this piece was just kind of open. Like I went down the rabbit hole after I read this the first time. It's just like, holy crap. Like this begins to touch on an argument and an idea that shows just how foundational the idea of money and subsequently its origins in collectibles and the simple desire to have these unforgeably costly items that could be exchanged and that we mutually value. It was just a really big shift for me during my journey down the rabbit hole, if you will. So I always love this piece, and I'm super, super happy to finally have this out in audio so that other people can listen to it. And like I said, don't forget to check out cryptoeconomy.life, because I'm going to have it probably early next week. Like I said, I'm out of town for the weekend. So when I get back into town, I'm going to work on this and make this one single download for anybody who wants to listen to it in full, kind of like it's an audiobook. That will be in the long reads section of the website at cryptoeconomy.life. So check that out if you ever want to listen to it again and you want to skip all the intro, outro, support the shows and, you know, music and all that good stuff. But with that, we will close this episode here. I hope everybody has had a wonderful week and has a wonderful weekend to boot. Don't forget to support the show and the work that I'm doing. If you are enjoying and getting something out of this, you can share it, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, follow me on Twitter, Mastodon. And I finally got a auto posting set up for Reddit. So you can all find all of this if you want to leave comments and stuff on Reddit. r/cryptoeconomy is our subreddit. So check us out up there if you want to drop comments. Obviously you can do it on cryptoeconomy.life as well. You can purchase the affiliate links that I have posted up on the website and all those great things. And of course, you can donate to my donation address. So thank you guys so much for listening. I will catch you all back here on Monday with some more great stuff on the Cryptoeconomy podcast. Take it easy, guys. We'll be right back.